Chapter number 65, Problem of Equity, page number 795. It is equitable that people in the same economic position should be treated in the same way for the purpose of taxation. But how to measure economic position? In order to achieve the ideal of justice in taxation, several principles have been suggested. We examine some of these principles below. Cost of service principle. It is said that it would be just if people are charged the cost of the services rendered to them. However, equitable it may appear to be, the cost of service principle cannot be applied in actual practice. The cost of service of the armed forces, police, etc., the services which are rendered out of tax proceeds, cannot be exactly determined. We have to calculate how much it costs to render a service to the particular taxpayer. We know that in case of taxes, there is no direct quid pro quo to the taxpayer. Hence, the question of ascertaining the cost of service to an individual taxpayer does not arise. Only in those cases where the services are rendered out of prices, example, supply of electricity, railway or postal service, a near approach can be made to charging according to the cost of service. Even here, the exact cost cannot be ascertained, and for fixing the charges, we have to fall back on the principle of charging what the service will bear. The cost of service principle, therefore, must be rejected as being impracticable. Benefit or quid pro quo theory. It is suggested that the taxes should be levied according to the benefit conferred on the taxpayers. But on grounds similar to those mentioned above, the benefit theory also breaks down when an attempt is made to give it a practical shape. Most of the public expenditure is incurred for common or indivisible benefits. It is impossible to calculate how much benefit accrues to a particular individual. There are a few cases only where the benefit to the individual is ascertainable, example, old age pensions. Applied to this case, the theory would demand a refund of the pension itself, for that precisely is the measure of the benefit. Nobody would seriously put forward such a proposal. It is therefore impossible to ask the people to contribute according to the benefits received by them. Page number 796. Several other objections can be raised against the benefit theory. It is against the basic principles of the tax. A tax is paid for the general purpose of the state and not in return for a specific service. The benefit theory can have meaning only if we think of the benefit to the community as a whole. But this is obviously useless for the purpose of taxing the individual. If you want to make some exceptions, you will be in a difficulty. On what basis will you make the exceptions? Moreover, it is commonly believed that the poor benefit more from the state activities than the rich. If that is so, then to apply the benefit theory would mean making these people pay who cannot afford to pay and letting off those who can and who should. This would be absurd. In the words of Pliny, common benefits are the peaceful enjoyment of life, liberty and property. So far as life and liberty are concerned, the benefit of state protection is the same for all. This would indicate a uniform tax, say a poll tax. But poll tax has been long discarded on account of its relatively small yield and greater cost and botheration of collection. If we take the protection of property as the basis, then it should be proportional tax, proportionate to the capital value or the income yielding capacity of the property. But proportional taxation has also been rejected in modern times as being less than just. We cannot therefore take benefit as a criterion of justice. The benefit theory has, however, a place in all modern tax systems. The idea of benefit stands out prominently in the case of fees, licenses, special assessment and local rating. Ability to pay or faculty theory. The most popular and the plausible theory of justice in taxation is that every taxpayer should be made to contribute according to his ability or faculty to pay. The tax is to be based on his taxable capacity. Nothing would appear to be more just. But the acceptance of the principle does not mean the end of our difficulties. Rather, the difficulties begin. The question which we then face is, what is the measure of a man's ability to pay? In the search for a proper criterion of a person's ability to contribute to the state exchequer, we can proceed on two lines, subjective and objective. Subjective approach. If we examine the position of the taxpayer in its subjective aspect, we shall consider the inconvenience, the pinch, or the sacrifice involved. On this point, three distinctive views have been advanced. A. The principle of equal sacrifice. B. The principle of proportional sacrifice. And C. The principle of minimum sacrifice. In the words of J.S. Mill, equality of taxation as a maximum of politics means equality of sacrifice. It means apportioning the contribution of each person towards the expenses of government, so that he shall feel neither more nor less inconvenience from his share of the payment than every other person experiences from his.
Reference note: Principle of Practical Economy, Book 5, Roman number 2, P2.
According to this principle, the money burden of taxation is to be so distributed as to impose equal real burden on the individual taxpayers. This would mean proportional taxation. According to the principle of proportional sacrifice, the real burden on the individual taxpayer is to be not equal but proportional either to their income or the economic welfare they derive. This would be more just than if the sacrifice involved were equal. Those who can make a greater sacrifice should be asked to do so. This would mean progressive taxation. The minimum sacrifice principle considers the body of taxpayers in the aggregate and not individually. According to this principle, the total real burden of the community should be as small as possible. Page number 797. In the words of Edgeworth, the chief exponent of the theory of minimum aggregate sacrifice, the minimum sacrifice is the sovereign principle of taxation. If one is a utilitarian and believes not only in the measurability of utility, but also in the view that the law of diminishing marginal utility is applicable to money also, then this principle would involve a high level of minimum exemption and a very steep progression as income increases. This is because if we assume that marginal utility of money falls as income increases, then money has less marginal utility to the rich than to the poor. And assuming that a given tax revenue is to be collected, it would involve least aggregate sacrifice if the tax revenue were to be collected from the people in the higher income brackets. The less the aggregate sacrifice, the better the distribution of the tax burden in the community. The state exists to maximize human welfare. This it will be able to do by minimizing the sacrifices involved. Cohen, Stewart, and Edgeworth developed the following three distinct features of equal sacrifice. 1. Equal absolute sacrifice. The principle of equity is based on ability to pay approach. The burden of tax on the taxpayers must be the same. In other words, U in brackets Y minus U in brackets Y minus T must be the same for all. Here, Y equals income, T equals tax, U equals utility. U in brackets Y equals pre-tax utility of income. U in brackets Y minus T equals post-tax utility of income. 2. Equal proportional sacrifice. Under this, the burden is same for all but is T taken in proportion to their income. Therefore, U in brackets Y minus U in brackets Y minus T divided by U in brackets Y. The only difference between equal absolute sacrifice and equal proportional is that we take only the difference between the pre-tax income satisfaction, but in the case of equal proportional, we divide it by the pre-tax income satisfaction. Therefore, equal absolute sacrifice divided by pre-tax income satisfaction. 3. Equal marginal sacrifice. In this concept, the marginal utility or satisfaction derived after the payment of tax must be the same for all. In this, we take the first order derivative of U in brackets Y minus T. Therefore, du in brackets Y minus T close brackets divided by D in brackets Y minus T close brackets is equal for all the individuals. Let us explain all these three concepts with the help of the following diagram. In the above figure on x-axis, the income is measured, and on y-axis up to OA is marginal utility, and from above A, total utility is measured. AB amount of income is exempted from tax, or it is subsistence income. Beyond this income, the tax will be imposed. BX is total utility curve and BY is marginal utility curve. Let us assume that taxpayer M has TM amount of income and taxpayer N has TN amount of income. M is getting GX amount of total utility. N is getting LP amount of total utility. M is getting MY amount of marginal utility. N is getting NR amount of marginal utility. Now let us assume that the government imposes income tax which yields SM amount of tax revenue. In case of A, equal absolute sacrifice, M will pay IM amount of tax and N will pay DN amount of tax. Therefore, IM plus DN equals SM. The amount of IM and DN we get and the loss of total utility of M is XU and that of N is PC. Therefore, XU equals PC. In the second case, that is equal proportional tax, M pays KM and N pays JN. Page number 798. Therefore, KM plus JN equals SM. This is obtained by XV by XG equals PE by PL. If we notice A and B, in the second case compared to the first case, M is paying more tax than N. C, in the third case of equal marginal sacrifice, M pays HM and N pays HN amount of tax. Therefore, HM plus HN equals SM. Aggregate sacrifice of both M, N is XW plus PF is minimum. Therefore, IM is greater than KM which is greater than HM for M taxpayer. Therefore, DN is greater than JN which is greater than HN for N taxpayer. Here is a table consisting of four columns. The first column is taxpayers. The second column is amount of tax paid by M. The third column is amount of tax paid by N. Fourth column is total tax yield. In the first case of equal absolute sacrifice, the amount of tax paid by M is IM. The amount of tax paid by N is DN. The total tax yield is SM. In the second case of equal proportional sacrifice, the amount of tax paid by M is KM. The amount of tax paid by N is JN. The total tax yield is SM. In the third case of equal marginal sacrifice, the amount of tax paid by M is HM, the amount of tax paid by N is HN, and the total tax yield is SM. Objective approach. We must therefore take our second line of approach to measure a man's ability to pay, that is, proceed objectively. Here we are on surer grounds. But here again we find that several criteria have been suggested. A man's ability to pay may be measured according to A. consumption, B. property, or C. income. Consumption as a criterion of ability to pay is not a sound criterion, because consumption or utilization of the services of the state by the poor is considered to be out of all proportion to their means, and as such it cannot be taken as a practical principle of taxation. Property also cannot be a fair basis of taxation, for properties of the same size and description may not yield the same amount of income. And some persons having no property to show may have large incomes, whereas men of large property may be getting small incomes. Thus, to tax according to property will not be taxation according to ability. Income, however, remains the single best test of a man's ability to pay. But even in the case of income, the tax will be in proportion ability, if there is a minimum exemption to allow for a reasonable subsistence, if there is an allowance made for the number of dependents, and finally, if the principle of progression is applied by taxing the rich at a higher rate. Besides, we have to consider the ability to pay not merely of the individual taxpayer, but of the community as a whole. In this light, it is necessary that the tax system as a whole is not oppressive. It should not discourage saving or retard accumulation of capital. Also, it should not in any manner impair the productive capacity of the community by hampering the development of trade and industry in the country. Summing up, this is the solution of the problem of justice in taxation. The ends of justice are not served by applying the cost of service principle or by taxing according to benefit, but according to faculty or the ability to pay. The ability to pay cannot be judged subjectively by the amount of sacrifice involved, but objectively according to the man's income and not according to his consumption or property. What is intended is that the tax system as a whole should be equitable. Each individual tax may not be absolutely just or equitable. The inequity of one tax may be neutralized by the equity of another. There may be inequity in the parts, but equity in the whole. It is said that equity is a matter of opinion. There is no generally accepted definition of equity. It is, in the words of Dalton, an elusive mistress whom perhaps it is only worth the while of philosophers to pursue ardently and of politicians to watch warily. Proportional versus progressive taxation. In our discussion of the various theories of a fair distribution of the tax burden, we have almost invariably been led to the conclusion that there must be some degree of progression, whether possible, in a tax. Case for proportional taxation. There have been advocates of proportional taxation. McCulloch's well-known remark is typical of the attitude of the 19th century. He said, "When you abandon the plain principle of proportion, you are at sea without rudder and compass, and there is no amount of injustice you may not commit." Page number 799. Case for proportional taxation. There have been advocates of proportional taxation. McCulloch's well-known remark is typical of the attitude of the 19th century. He said, "When you abandon the plain principle of proportion, you are at sea without a rudder and compass, and there is no amount of injustice you may not commit." J.S. Mill was even more emphatic. He said, "A graduated income tax was an entirely unjust mode of taxation, and in fact a graduated robbery." According to him, progressive taxation was a step towards confiscation. Case against. According to the principle of equality of sacrifice, proportional taxation could be justified only on the assumption that the marginal utility of income decreases slowly as income increases. But this assumption is not correct. If we keep in view the principle of proportional sacrifice, then the proportional tax can be justified only on the assumption that as income increases, the marginal utility of income does not at all decrease. This assumption is absurd because when income increases, its marginal utility must decrease. Hence, proportional taxation can be justified neither on the principle of equality of sacrifice nor on the principle of proportional sacrifice. Proportional taxation will entail equal sacrifice, whereas sacrifice itself should be proportional to the taxpayer's capacity. Proportional taxation is therefore not equitable. Further, it is also not sufficiently productive. Moreover, the element of arbitrariness, even in proportional taxation, is not altogether absent. Hence, the theory of proportional taxation has been abandoned generally so far as direct taxation is concerned, and wherever possible, the principle of progressive taxation has been adopted instead. Case for progressive taxation. The principles of progressive taxation is justified on the following grounds. A. It is argued that as income increases, the utility of each addition to the income decreases. Hence, the payment of the tax by the rich entails much less sacrifice than by the poor. The rich people should therefore pay tax at high rates. B. It is further argued that as income increases, the expenditure on luxuries tends to increase, whereas necessaries are more important than luxuries from the point of view of economic welfare. It follows, therefore, that by taxing the rich more, we only compel them to cut down on luxuries. The sacrifice so entailed is not as great as the benefit to the poor on whom the tax proceeds may be spent. C. Progressive taxation yields much greater revenue and hence it is more productive. It is very difficult to see how modern governments can balance their budgets today in the absence of the principle of progression. D. Progressive taxation is more economical and equitable. The cost of collection of the taxes does not increase when the rate of the tax increases. About the equity of progressive taxation, there can be no question. It calls forth a proportional sacrifice from the taxpayers. It places the heaviest burden on the broadest shoulders. The principle of progression gives to the tax system much needed elasticity or flexibility. When there is an emergency, only a little raising of the rates may be sufficient to meet the situation. F. The maintenance of law and order by the government benefits the rich much more than the poor. It enables the rich to make much more money. It is only proper, therefore, that they pay taxes at progressively higher rates. G. Progressive taxation promotes economic stability and checks cyclical fluctuations. Progressive taxes mop up the purchasing power in the hands of the people. In this way, they ease inflationary pressures. In a deflationary situation, on the other hand, the amount of tax paid would fall as income falls, and a much larger proportion of income may be left in the hands of the taxpayer to be spent. This would arrest the deflationary tendency. Hence, progressive taxes are contra-cyclical. H. Progressive taxes are badly needed for reducing economic inequalities and for bringing about more equitable distribution of wealth in the community. It would curb the luxurious living of the rich, which is resented by the poor, who cannot even have basic necessities of life. Page number 800. I. Progressive taxes may increase the desire to work, save and invest on the part of the rich, because they are keen to have the same sum after the tax as before the tax. Case against. The opponents of the progressive principle have raised several objections against the system. We examine below some of these objections. A. It is said that it is all arbitrary. The degree of progression is settled by the finance minister on no definite and scientific basis. It is purely his personal opinion. Clearly, the objection is not on to the degree of progression. Although progression cannot be scientifically fixed, yet for practical purposes, small differences do not matter. The members of the legislature are there to set right the angularities of the Chancellor of the Exchequer. B. It is pointed out that the principle of progression cannot be advocated on the ground of promoting welfare because welfare is subjective and cannot be measured. There is no scientific apparatus to test whether welfare has increased consequent on reduction of inequalities of income. The rich are perhaps vexed more than the poor are comforted. C. Again, it is said that progression will discourage saving, drive out capital, and thus hamper trade and industry. It will in short be uneconomical. But such dire consequences will follow only if the rate of progression exceeds the limits of reason and expediency. This has seldom been the case. Capital is not so sensitive as it is supposed to be. D. The principle of progression is said to break down on scientific grounds. Its fundamental assumption that the same income measures the same satisfaction is not at all valid. Further, the law of diminishing marginal utility may not hold good in the case of money. Money, they say, does not represent one good, but goods in general. And since human wants in general are unlimited, it may be questioned whether the wealthy person does require the additional pounds less and less. It may even be that his desire for additional income increases as his income increases. Such may be the case when an increase in income causes the possessor to move into a higher social circle and so bring about an extension of his necessary wants.
Reference notes. Thomas S.E. Elements of Economics, 1936, p. 332.
But Robbins regards the use of the principle of diminishing marginal utility in this field as entirely illegitimate and unscientific.
Reference note. Robbins L. The Nature and Significance of Economic Science, 1931, Chapter 6.
Marginal utility being subjective cannot be ascertained by observation. As Robbins says, there is no means of testing the magnitude of A's satisfaction as compared with B's. Introspection does not enable A to measure what is going on in B's mind, nor B to measure what is going on in A's. In progressive taxation, we assume that persons with same income derive equal satisfaction therefrom. But we cannot prove that this assumption rests on ascertainable fact because satisfaction cannot be measured. It would be rather silly, says Robbins, if we continued to pretend that the justification of scheme of things was in a way scientific. If we continued to pretend that the justification of scheme of things was in any way scientific. Although on scientific grounds the argument is unanswerable, but progression can be advocated equally strongly on ethical and political grounds. E. Investments which are risky but which yield rich harvest are discouraged because the proportion of tax increases as income increases. Reduction of investment will reduce the level of income and employment in the country. F. Progressive taxes put premium on idleness and leisure since they penalize those who work hard and make more money. It amounts almost to graduated confiscation of rich man's income. G. It is said that progression will lead to tax evasion. But the possibility of evasion in proportional taxation is not less. It all depends on the social conscience. Conclusion. Progressive taxation, whether it can be scientifically justified or not, is ethically sound, socially desirable, and it conforms to the canons of equity, economy, productivity, and elasticity. This principle has been universally adopted in all tax systems. Page number 801. Taxable capacity. The concept of taxable capacity had racked the brains of not a few economists and publicists. Dalton calls it a dim and confused conception. He says absolute taxable capacity is a myth and should be banished from all serious discussions on public finance. To the question whether taxable capacity can be measured, he thinks canons know how is the best answer. Findlay Shiras, on the other hand, thinks that it is of great practical importance. It is always wise and useful, he says, for a government to know even roughly the limit that the country can contribute by way of taxation, both in the ordinary and extraordinary circumstances. He goes on, the necessity in post-war finance, especially of balancing budgets heavily laden with public debt of short maturity, has made the question of absolute taxable capacity a real and an abiding problem of taxation.
Reference note: Science of Public Finance, 1936, p. 227.
Meaning, the term taxable capacity can be used in two senses: A. In the absolute sense, and B. In the relative sense. The absolute taxable capacity has been variously defined. It means how much a particular community can pay in the form of taxes without producing unpleasant effects. Relative taxable capacity, on the other hand, means the respective contribution which the two communities should make towards a common expenditure. Example, provincial contribution to central expenditure. Dalton says the former is a myth and the latter a reality. The relative limit may be reached without reaching the absolute limit, that is, we may have reached the limit of how much a particular community should contribute without reaching the limit beyond which it possibly cannot contribute. Absolute taxable capacity. There are two extreme views with absolute taxable capacity: the capacity to pay without suffering and the capacity to pay regardless of suffering. In the former sense, taxable capacity is practically nil, for every tax must entail some suffering. In the latter case, there is practically no limit to taxable capacity except the one imposed by the extent of the resources of the community. Sir Josiah Stamp defines taxable capacity as the margin of total production over total consumption, or the amount required to maintain the population at subsistence level. This means the utmost that a community can pay without having a really unhappy, downtrodden existence and without dislocating the organization too much. Findlay Shiras defines absolute taxable capacity as the maximum amount which the citizens of a country can contribute towards the expense of the public authorities without having to undergo an unbearable strain. Briefly, taxable capacity is the limit of squeezability. It is the taxation of a nation, the minimum amount of taxation of a nation, the maximum amount of taxation that can be raised and spent to produce the maximum economic welfare in that community. These definitions lack scientific precision and have an element of vagueness. Sir Stamp's level of subsistence and unhappy downtrodden existence, and Shiras's unbearable strain and maximum economic welfare cannot be scientifically defined and laid down in exact terms. This, however, does not detract from the practical importance and the utility of the concept of taxable capacity. The meaning conveyed by the definitions given above is fairly clear, although we must admit that any attempt to measure the taxable capacity is foredoomed to failure. Canons know-how is really the correct answer. Limit of taxable capacity. Views also differ as to what are the symptoms to show that taxable capacity has been exceeded. Sir Stamp mentions two limits: A. The check to total production, and B. The check to total revenue yield. But the check may be due to causes other than excessive taxation. Taxation is not the only factor that affects production. Ellinger thinks that the limits would be reached when so much is taken out of the taxpayers' pockets that the incentive to produce is reduced, and when insufficient remains to provide the necessary capital to make up for wastage and to set to work new workers in an increasing population. He obviously ignores the beneficent effect of public expenditure on production. Factors governing taxable capacity. The fact is that the taxable capacity is not rigidly fixed. It is a moving point. It is relative to so many factors that any change in any of them is bound to change our estimate about the taxable capacity of a nation. Findlay Shiraz gives the following factors which determine the taxable capacity of a nation. Page number 802. A. Number of inhabitants. It is quite obvious that the larger the population, the greater is the taxable capacity of the community to contribute towards the expenses of the government. From this point of view, India is well placed. Its taxable capacity will infinitely increase when the country is economically developed. B. Distribution of wealth. If wealth is more equally distributed, the taxable capacity will be correspondingly reduced. But if there are large accumulations of wealth in a few hands, the government can raise more money by taxing the rich. C. Method of taxation. A scientifically constructed tax system with a wise admixture of the various types of taxes, direct and indirect, is sure to bring a larger yield. The Indian tax system is not much diversified. There are no taxes on large agricultural incomes. This certainly reduces the taxable capacity. D. Purpose of taxation. If the purpose of taxation is to promote welfare of the people, they will be more willing to pay tax themselves. For a popular cause, the people will be willing to stretch their capacity to the utmost. If the government proceeds to raise money for fighting famine, disease, or for the spread of education, there will be a surprising expansion in the yield of taxes. But if the bulk of the public funds is to spend on the maintenance of foreign armed forces and for the upkeep of a costly civil service, the case in India, the taxable capacity must correspondingly shrink. E. Psychology of taxpayers. Much depends on the people's attitude towards a government. A popular government can galvanize the spirit of the people and prepare them for a greater sacrifice. An appeal to patriotism is often the cause of the success of a financial measure. That is what makes war loans successful. Psychology of the people is an important factor, and unless they are properly approached, they may be unwilling to tax themselves. F. Stability of income. If the income of the citizens is precarious, there will not be much scope for further taxation. The vagaries of the monsoons in India account for a lower taxable capacity. It is only on stable incomes that long-term financial arrangements can be based. G. Inflation. It lowers the purchasing power of the people and it cripples many. It has an adverse effect on taxable capacity. H. Level of economic development. The level of economic development attained by a country is an important determinant on its taxable capacity. Undoubtedly, all highly developed countries of the world have greater taxable capacity than the underdeveloped countries. I. Taxable capacity in a country also depends on political conditions prevailing at the time. Political stability relieves businessmen of all worries and uncertainty. It provides a congenial climate for the blossoming of variegated economic activity. On the other hand, political upheavals sap all business activity and hence adversely affect taxable capacity. Conclusion. All these factors must be taken into account before we can have an idea about the taxable capacity of a nation. It may be that on account of the multiplicity of the factors influencing taxable capacity, we cannot measure this capacity. But this does not mean that the attempt is useless. The interest lies in the journey itself rather than in the destination. As Finlay Shiras puts it, a road leading to an important center has often many crossings, signposts, danger signals. But this does not lessen its value to the cautious sojourner. A further note on case for progressive taxation. We have already discussed the case for and against progressive taxation. We should like to add a further note on the case for progressive taxation. The terms proportional, progressive, and regressive refer to the relation between the tax rate and the tax base. But a sales tax is typically a proportional tax because the rate is the same whatever the tax base. It is, however, regressive when it is related to the buyer's income because rich and poor shall be paying at the same rate. Thus, a tax may be proportional with regard to the tax base but regressive with respect to income. The case for progressive taxation rests on the grounds of A. Revenue productivity, B. Optimum allocation of the tax burden, C. Promotion of stability and growth, and D. Optimum allocation of resources. For revenue productivity, the rising requirements of the state for providing social goods need a large revenue to meet them. The government cannot increase the rates of proportional taxation because that would press heavily on the poor. Obviously, the new rate increase must be concentrated on the rich people. Hence, the only way to raise more revenue with less outcry is to resort to progressive taxation. For optimum allocation of tax burden, marginal utility principle is helpful in this connection. It is as applicable to income as to goods. It is obvious that paying one additional rupee as tax from a large income is less burdensome than giving up a marginal rupee of a small income. In other words, if we want to equalize tax burdens, we should take a larger number of rupees from a large income than from a small income. Page number 803. For promoting growth and stability, a progressive tax has an automatic counter-cyclical effect. As income rises, marginal income pushes into higher brackets, raising both the marginal and average tax rates on these incomes. It is obvious that with progressive rates, taxes rise and fall more rapidly than income, whereas the proportional rates change the tax in proportion to income. Progression thus has the maximum counter-cyclical effect. It may also be noted that this effect is automatic and immediate and does not require any legislation. It may be clearly understood that this automatic reaction is not the result of progression in tax rates, but because income is the tax base. Since individual income tax is progressive, it is regarded as an effective instrument reacting favorably, quickly, and strongly in the interest of economic stability. For optimum allocation of resources, progressive taxation can also be justified on the ground that it brings about optimum allocation of community's resources. Certain goods are considered preferable to others. It is therefore necessary that the community's resources should be allocated to the production of certain goods, which are considered worthwhile rather than to others, while may be trivial or unimportant. Social judgment is substituted for individual preference in order to select goods which are preferable. It can be assumed that large incomes are preferable. It can be assumed that large incomes are more likely to be utilized in the satisfaction of trivial wants than small incomes. There is thus a case for heavier taxation of large incomes. In this way, progressive taxation can be used as an instrument for redistribution of income and resources in the community for achieving social objectives. Conclusion. The diminishing marginal utility argument may not be very scientific, but it is broadly correct. And the case for progressive taxation on the ground of revenue productivity, compensatory use, and redistribution of communities' resources is clear and strong. Nobody now seriously questions the validity and necessity of progressive taxation. If there is any difference of opinion, it is only about the degree of progression. Key terms: ability to pay, equal absolute sacrifice, equal marginal sacrifice, equal proportional sacrifice, taxable capacity. Questions: 1. What are the principles of taxation? Explain the difficulties involved in following these principles in practice. 2. Define tax. What are the characteristics of a good tax system? 3. What is the significance of equity in the principles of taxation? How is equity introduced in a tax system? 4. Expenditure is a better index of ability of pay than income. Elucidate. 5. The principle of equity necessarily implies least aggregate sacrifice for society. Discuss. 6. What do you understand by the principle of minimum sacrifice? What is its usefulness and application in the theory of taxation?